Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco. My name is Bob Saldick. I am chairman of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and I will serve as your chair and the moderator for tonight's discussion. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Charles Freed, professor of law at Harvard University, the author of Modern Liberty and the Limits of Government. Mr. Freed has a fascinating background. He was born in Prague in Czechoslovakia. He became a United States citizen in 1948. He received his BA degree from Princeton in 1956. He attended Oxford University, bachelor's and a master's degree in 58 and 60. In 1960, he received the Juris Doctor degree from Columbia University School of Law. He subsequently served as a law clerk to Associate Justice John Marshall Harlan. Mr. Freed is admitted to the bars of the United States Supreme Court, the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, and the District of Columbia, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, along with an assortment of several other circuit courts. He has served as counsel to a number of major law firms and clients, and before the Supreme Court, as well as in many other court venues. Mr. Freed's government service included a year as Special Assistant to the Attorney General of the United States, which was 1984-5. In October of 85, Mr. Freed was appointed Solicitor General of the United States. During his term of office, he represented the Reagan administration before the Supreme Court in 25 cases. At the end of the Reagan administration, back to the Harvard Law School. Then from September 95 and through 94, in 1999, he was an Associate Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts while teaching at Harvard Law School constitutional law as a distinguished lecturer. In 1999, back again to Harvard Law School as a full-time member of the faculty and the beneficial professor of law. He's published extensively. He's author of 7 books, 30 journal articles, and his work has appeared in over a dozen different collections. He was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. He is a member of the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Law Institute. Mr. Freed's biography even appears in Wikipedia, which he was surprised to learn about tonight. His current book is Modern Liberty and the Limits of Government, Issues of Our Time. A reviewer says that Mr. Freed's entire theory is built upon the value of individual rationality, and his argument fully engages the rationality of his interlocutors. He does not belittle or insult anyone's ideas. He presents their arguments in good faith and in the best light possible, and then demonstrates what is wrong with them. With great pleasure, I introduce Charles Freed.
Thank you, Bob. It's very nice to be here. This, after all, the United States is the land of liberty, and California is the state of liberty and the land of liberty, so it's very good to be here. Well, liberty has been a lifelong preoccupation for me, and I think that it's my biography explains that a little bit. I was born in Czechoslovakia, which, when I was born, 1935, was a prosperous, multi-ethnic, democratic, highly educated, beautiful country, very prosperous, very little poverty, and a free country, very democratic. It was in a real way a land of milk and honey. Unfortunately, a small country. And in 1939, which is the year I left, overrun by one dictator and then another. The first, they both had one thing in common, Hitler and Stalin. They both hated liberty. And they did their best to stamp it out in countries like Czechoslovakia. Jan Masaryk, who was a great libertarian and a great apostle of liberty, they threw out a window in the Hradčany castle, which is a famous Czech form of assassination, defenestration. They both hated liberty. Hitler hated it because he cared about one thing and one thing only. He didn't care about people. He cared about the glory of a race, the German race. Stalin, on the other hand, also didn't care about people. He cared about peoples, and particularly he cared about equality, but he hated liberty. So what Czechoslovakia means to me, and it's interesting to come, my parents had lived both in the creation of the country and through its heyday and then through its fall, is a kind of paradise lost. But to us, to my family, and to me, the United States was paradise regained. This is the land of liberty. And what I've been moved by as a philosopher, as a law teacher, as a lawyer, as a judge, is to think about the liberty which I think is distinctive in this great country, this remarkable country, this country which is liberty exemplified. And so what I'd like to do is ask you to meditate with me about, you don't have to close your eyes and find a mantra, meditate with me about this idea of liberty, because that's what I've done in this book. It's a meditation about liberty. And of course, being a meditation about liberty, it's not appropriate. It's not appropriate to try and knock over, stamp upon, and murder the people who may not agree with you, who have doubts about what you have to say. On the contrary, what you want to do is gently bring them along and hope you can persuade them. Now, I'm certainly not, and I don't have the time, and you won't give me the time, to take you on the whole journey of this book. It's a short book. It's a short book. It could be read on a transcontinental flight, I think. My great friend Stephen Breyer has written an even shorter book, which could be read on the way to Chicago, which is Active Liberty. And actually, on Friday, we had a very interesting conversation about that. But I'd like to just start you thinking about it and give you some sense of what I think about it, and then I hope we'll have time for your questions and my reactions to them and a conversation. Well, the thing I thought I might start with is something that got under my skin, and it got under my skin just this morning. You may have seen it in the papers. The egregious Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, president of Iran, is hosting a conference on whether the Holocaust really happened. Now, what's so creepy about that? In some sense, it's really a good thing. After all, it asks a question. And that's always a fair thing to do. It asks a question. And compare it to Turkey. In Turkey, it is a crime to deny the Armenian Holocaust. And no sane person with any knowledge of the facts would deny that the Turks in the early 20s under Kemal Atatürk murdered about 1 million Armenians. In fact, many think that the Turkish Holocaust was the model and the template for Hitler's Holocaust. He showed them that it really could be done. Or compare it now not to Turkey, but to France, Germany, and yes, Canada, where it is an offense against the law to deny the Holocaust, to ask the questions that Ahmadinejad is asking in his so-called conference. And France has just passed legislation, not yet approved, to make it a crime to deny the Armenian Holocaust. So that which it is a crime to affirm in Turkey, it is a crime to deny in France. Well, what's so weird about all of this? What's weird about this is that in each case, it proclaims something that I would call official truth. And official truth is, to my mind, almost like a contradiction in terms, a governmental truth. Ahmadinejad is proclaiming official doubt. But official doubt or official truth is the wrong notion of government, because truth judges government. Government does not judge truth. So what I think, when I thought about it, what was creepy about Ahmadinejad's conference and about the Turkish and the French and the German and the Canadian legislation is that government is judging truth, whereas in fact, truth judges government. Well, that's truth, and my subject is liberty. So what's the connection? Well, truth has to do with the mind. Truth is that which persuades the mind, which is why, of course, the notion of official truth is such a contradiction in terms. Truth persuades the mind, and the mind is the seat of liberty. My thesis is the thesis of self-ownership. We, each of us, own ourselves. The community doesn't own us. Our family doesn't own us. The government doesn't own us. Everybody owns himself. And that starts with the idea that everybody owns his own mind. Let's take a more challenging example than Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Take the market. Now, that's an interesting thing. For many, I think all professional economists, I had a discussion about this book with my very good friend and former president, Larry Summers, in which he's an excellent economist, said what most economists would say about the market. The market is a device, purely instrumental, for efficiency, effectiveness, prosperity. And for that reason, it is something of an intellectual scandal. For that reason, the market has always been a temptation for people who think they can do better. After all, the market is just people doing what they do. That's not good enough. Imagine, for instance, if we treated our health the way we treat the market. We don't just leave our health alone. We intervene. We take medicine. We have surgery. We don't just leave the weather alone. We put up an umbrella. We create global warming. We don't just leave things alone. And so the market seems strange. It has always been a temptation for getting in there and controlling it Everybody seems to think, every tin pot politician thinks that he can do better than the market. And that's, in fact, a very understandable temptation if the market is viewed as a device for producing economic prosperity. But it's not. That's not what it is. The market is, in fact, a crossroads of liberty. It is a huge network of exchange of persons exchanging not just goods, but goods and services, but of work, of conversation, of words, of ideas, of music, of love. And the market is just people. You and me exchanging first goods, and then maybe words, and maybe ideas, and maybe affection and friendship. And not just you and me, but you and our friends, and our friends together, and then our society, and our country, and the world. As Beethoven in the Ninth Symphony, diesen Küsten ganzen Welt. But it is free people simply interacting. Oh, yes, but what about money? You see, money comes into it, and that's supposed to make everything dirty and second rate. But you think about it, what is money? Money actually is a wonderful invention. And it's not just the economists who should appreciate money. They have a lot to say about it. But I am a human being and a lover of liberty, and I want to tell you something else about money. What money is a way for you and me to exchange things which we don't have yet. What a marvelous invention. What a marvelous increase of our liberty. I have a hat. You make wonderful shoes. You want my hat. I want a pair of your shoes, but you don't have them yet. Fine. I give you my hat. You give me money, and then I can buy the shoes 6 months later when you have made them. Money is simply a storehouse of promises which we make to each other. So there's nothing, you know, money sometimes has the term filthy lucre, but it isn't. Money is really quite wonderful. It is a medium of exchange, and exchange is wonderful because exchange is free people exchanging with each other. Not so long ago, my great friend and remarkable human being, if I didn't know him, I would think he was several human beings, Richard Posner, who writes a book in the time it takes for me to read one, the judge in Illinois, created something of an intellectual scandal by talking, as many economists do, about markets for art, markets for love, markets for sex, markets for babies. And people thought, that's just terrible. But why is it terrible? Well, it's just terrible because what it does, it seems to devalue, bring down to the level of filthy lucre, of hats and shoes and goods and services, these wonderful things like words and art and literature and conversation and so on. But that is a terrible mistake. It gets it the wrong way around. What that argument does, it elevates, as I would like to elevate, the exchange of goods and services to the level of the exchange which we have, for instance, in conversation. This very book that I've written, this very lecture, is an exchange between you and me. It is a loving exchange. I love talking to you. I hope you like listening, and you are going to ask me questions, and that will be more of an exchange. Is that really different than the exchange of my hat for your shoes? I don't think so. You expend yourself in making those shoes, and I expend myself in writing this book and giving this lecture. It is me. I'm giving you something of myself. Well, in all of these things, we start with the phenomenon of perceiving, thinking, judging, choosing. That's who we are. We see. Nobody sees for us. Nobody uses our eyes. Nobody eats our meals for us. Nobody makes love for us. These are all things that we do for ourselves. And we think for ourselves. Now, it may be we think that we are going to let, I don't know who, Rush Limbaugh, or you take your favorite person. We're going to let Rush do all our thinking for us, or the New York Times editorial page do our thinking for us. But still, that is a choice we have to make. And in the end, that thinking, perceiving, choosing, feeling is what I call liberty of the mind. And nobody can interfere with that, may interfere with that, because that is the center of our individuality. That is what makes us individuals. Those of you who have seen children grow up have the wonderful experience of seeing that child who at first has no sense of herself. She's just a little blob. She eats and so on. But gradually, she begins to see herself as a distinct person, not the same as her mother or her brothers, someone separate, feeling separately, judging alone. And, of course, feeling separate, then choosing to be together. Choosing to be together. And it is this notion of individuality which is at the heart of liberty, what I call liberty as individuality made normative. Liberty is simply making a principle out of this fact that we are individuals, we have only one life to live, that is our life. We are responsible for what it is. We are responsible for what we make it. If we give it away to someone else, we'll never get it back. Well, what about family, community, society, government? Don't these nurture, ensure, protect us? Yes, but they too are crossroads of liberty. Think of the child again. It looks like that governments are bigger than individuals, because after all, government is there before we were, it will be there afterwards. Similarly, with language, the English language was there before we learned to speak it, it will be there after we have spoken it, after we are dead. But the fact that we pass through these institutions doesn't mean that these institutions, in order to be anything at all, can be anything other than the crossroads, like the market, the crossroads of the encounters of the actual individual persons whose life is lived in that language, in those institutions, in those families, in those communities. Just so that I don't speak just one way, let me, and this is in honor of the person who Bob cited, here's something I quote in my book, and it's not I writing. It's somebody writing against the point of view I've just stated. And I think it's a wonderful paragraph. I'm very moved by it. Some libertarians fantasize about the possibility that all the land in a society might be held as private property. This would be catastrophic for the homeless, since most private proprietors are already disposed to exclude him from their property. The homeless person might discover in such a libertarian paradise that there was literally nowhere he was allowed to be. It would not be entirely mischievous to add that since, in order to exist, a person has to be somewhere, such a person would not be permitted to exist. Well, I have to make room for that. I want to make room for that. I want to make room for the homeless. I start, now I'm going to speed this up because I want your questions. I want the discussion with you. That's what a liberal-minded person would be looking for. It's the exchange I want, the crossroads between you and me. I've talked about the liberty of the mind and how you can't get past that. That is the bedrock. Well, from the mind, I pass to the body. There are problems about the body. That passage I read you points them out. The body occupies space, and the space has got to belong to someone. And someone may not want that body of yours in their space. But some people may. And that's why I pass from the mind to the body, which is also mine, just as much as my mind, and from the body to sex, because sex is, after all, where, there's a marvelous quotation again, not me, I won't read anything that I've written. This comes from a marvelous film, I don't know, however many of you have seen Jean Renoir's Les Règles du Jeu, and a beautiful woman is speaking to her lover, and she says, "L'amour tel qu'il existe dans la société n'est que l'échange de deux fantaisies et le contact de deux épidermes. Love, as it exists in society, is nothing but the exchange of two fantasies, the mind, and the contact of two epidermises, the body." So liberty demands that. That's why the Supreme Court finally reached the right conclusion a few years ago in the Texas homosexual sodomy case. But from mind to body to sex, I come to work. Is not work mine in the way that sex and the body and the mind and the conversation are mine? And if work, then not, why not property? Here are the dilemmas. Here is the problem. In the book, let me tantalize you, in the book I take up three difficult problems. They are difficult for me, and I try to make them as difficult as possible. One of them is a proposal by the National Trust for Historic Preservation that all of the state of Vermont be made a Walmart-free zone. Now, a lot of people get all upset about Walmart's labor practices. I don't want to get into that because that's not my subject. What people talk about when they're doing that is they worry that Walmart coming in drives out the local merchants, these wonderful little main streets of Vermont with a Cracker Barrel general store where people get together and chat and so on and so forth, they can't stand the competition. And they wither up, and these town centers are boarded up, become derelict, and disappear. So they want to make it if you don't like Walmart, take Target. If you don't like Target, take Best Buy. Same point. What about that? It sounds like it makes sense. It does make sense, but it offends liberty in a way that I'd be happy to explain. Then there's another example, which I absolutely adore, and it exists, and that is in the province of Quebec, the Charter of the French Language. The French are a majority in Quebec, and maybe will be for a little while longer. A lot of immigration. And for several centuries, they felt like strangers in their own country because English dominated it. And then they took over. And they said, no. Everybody's got to speak French. All business has got to be in French. All official communications have got to be in French, and so on and so forth. The case that caught my eye was the case of a stone cutter. He made monuments for cemeteries, Jewish cemeteries. And there was a sign on his store in stone, which his grandfather had made. He was told he must take it down. Why? Because it was in Hebrew, and he must have, all signs must have, French as well as a foreign language, and the French must be at least as prominent, if not more. So he had to take that sign down. There's a more comical example of a grandmother in Ontario who wanted to send her child a talking doll, but couldn't because the doll spoke only English. And then there's a third example, which is universal health care. Terrific. I'm all for it. But how about mandatory, inescapable, one only health care? A little bit like mandatory public education, but with no private schools and no homeschooling. How about that? Well, these are all difficult cases, but they all offend against what I would call the spirit of liberty, and it's difficult to say why, which is what I tried to do. But I'm going to stop now because I see that there's a lot of questions there, and that's the fun of it. So let's go.
Terrific.
Bob, what do you got for me?
Our thanks to Charles Fried, professor of law at Harvard University and the author of Modern Liberty and the Limits of Government. We thank our audiences here and on the radio for listening in. We have a lot of questions, Mr. Fried. First of all, I was happy to point out to him the curious fact that Mr. Fried is writing about liberty. I thought that was good.
Yeah, it's spelt the wrong way. It comes from the German word for peace, so and that won't do, but it's it's fun. It's what's called a homonym.
We have a whole host of questions all around this general question. Is liberty being threatened and at risk in the U.S.? What do you consider the most dangerous threats to our liberty? How would you characterize the state of liberty? What do you think of our policy in Iraq as related to liberty? And maybe you can muse about that.
Well, all of those questions don't surprise me. And I'm going to say right off, they are not my subject. Because things like the Patriot Act and warrantless wiretapping, about which we could talk quite a bit, and I doubt many of you would agree with me, are on a different wavelength. You could be right about them, I could be wrong, and I could still be right about everything I talk about. Because I'm not talking about what the government does to defend us against people who we think, who we suspect, who we know are trying to kill us. That's a different story. I'm talking about regulations. Think about the Charter of the French Language in Quebec. I'm talking about regulations directed against law, or to, if not against, towards, or for, law-abiding people who will obey the rules, whatever they are. And the question is, well, what should those rules be? When we talk about the Patriot Act, when we talk about the things that those questioners are concerned about, they are talking about the limit which the collectivity can go to protect us against those who would deprive us of our liberties. And that's a very difficult question. I don't mean to say that there aren't any limits. Of course there are. It's just a different question.
Maybe you would comment on this question. To what extent does liberty demand personal responsibility in order to avoid intrusions on others' liberty?
Oh, I think that is absolutely central. My liberty is something that comes out of the respect I demand for my individuality. But if I do not respect the individuality of others, I cannot claim respect for my own individuality. And here, let me quote again, not from myself, but from a greater man than I or many of us, and you can tell in a little while who it is, but I'll let you guess. Here it is. If A can prove, however conclusively, that he may of right enslave B, why may not B snatch the same argument and prove equally that he may enslave A? You say A is white and B is black. It is color, then, the lighter having the right to enslave the darker. Take care. By this rule, you are to be a slave to the first man you meet with a fairer skin than your own. You do not mean color exactly. You mean the whites are intellectually superior of the blacks and therefore have the right to enslave them. Take care again. By this rule, you are to be slave to the first man you meet with an intellect superior to your own. But, say you, it is a question of interest, and if you can make it your interest, you have the right to enslave another. Very well, and if he can make it his interest, he has the right to enslave you. You know who said that? That's, of course, Lincoln, in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I think that's about as good an answer as I can give to that question, and it's not my answer, it's Lincoln's. Much better than anything I could do.
Let's move on to money. Here's a question from the audience. While money is per se not crass or evil, is it not the case that vast concentrations of money in the hands of few to the exclusion of others leads to evil? What role or roles does or should the government take in encouraging or discovering this concentration of wealth?
Well, government stands for us in protecting our liberty and protecting our humanity. And that means, to me, not making us all equal in everything we have, because that would be a terrible thing, an offense against liberty, but rather assuring that every person has the opportunity and the dignity to assert some liberty. That means the expenditure of resources, and that means taxation which taxes those who have more for the sake of those who have less. On the other hand, to tax simply for the purpose of bringing some people down when no one is brought up is an offense against liberty and puts the shibboleth of equality, Stalin, Pol Pot, above the great principle of liberty. That's how I'd answer that.
We have several questions about the media, so let me try this one. Do you believe in an absolutely free press? How do you feel about reporters threatened with jail time for not revealing their sources?
Oh, I'm all for putting them in the slammer like everybody else. If your brother-in-law told you something which was relevant in a court of law, the prosecutor, the opposite party, the judge can make you say what your brother-in-law, whom you love, told you. And if you don't say, you go to jail. Why should a reporter be any different? My belief in the freedom of the press, and I'm all for it, I'm all for it because I'm in the believe in the freedom of everybody. And there is, in my mind, no such thing as a special class of speakers called reporters. And in this day of the blogosphere, I am proved right. Anybody could be a reporter. And if anybody could be a reporter, nobody would testify in court. And that's absurd.
Takes care of them. The Supreme Court.
May I ask what that 20 means? Is that directed at me?
No.
Oh, good. Okay, well, I won't pay attention to
it. That's our timekeeper, and I'm in charge.
Okay, good. All right.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court a little bit. You've had extensive experience with the Supreme Court.
Yes. I've lost a lot of cases. I have won some, too.
We'd love to hear about both, but let me ask you this question. How political, that is, affected by politics, do you think the U.S. Supreme Court is?
It's not immune to politics, no. But it is a wonderful institution. It is an institution we should be terribly proud of. And let me tell you why. And you can see this for yourselves now, because many of the important cases are put on the Supreme Court's website. The oral argument is there for you to hear, sometimes within an hour of its being finished, and you can hear it. And what you will see, what you will hear, rather, is that here is an organ of government that works by listening to and responding to arguments. Arguments are all they are. And it acts by giving reasons. The president and the Congress act, not to mention sheriffs, cops, and other assorted government officials, act by acting. They sign laws, they put handcuffs on you, whatever. The Supreme Court acts, and courts act, by giving reasons. Their reasons are their actions. And if you listen to those arguments and you read those reasons, you have grounds for being proud of this institution. You listen to those arguments and you see that those nine justices have studied the case scrupulously before that argument. They couldn't ask those questions if they hadn't studied it. Nobody studied it for them. They studied it. And they asked the questions in order to make up their minds. And that is a remarkable thing. It is the negation of bureaucracy. It is government at its best.
Let's talk a little bit about the current administration. The president has taken advantage of signing statements, much more extensively than any previous president. What's your view of that? Are they really law, and are they binding on his successor?
No. And the whole thing about signing statements is an enormous manufactured canard. The president, from the time of George Washington, has believed and been supported in the belief that if a law is unconstitutional for any of a number of reasons, he not only doesn't have to, he may not implement it. And all presidents have decided not to implement parts or all of certain laws for that reason. What a signing statement does is it tells you right up front, hey, I think this is unconstitutional and I'm not going to do it. What other presidents have done is they just haven't done it. They haven't told you in advance. Now, what also has happened to those other presidents, and certainly has happened and will happen to this president, is people take him to court and the court says, well, you're wrong. It's not unconstitutional and you have to do it. Fine. But the fact that he announces to us beforehand his judgment is something one can't complain about. Well, you can complain about anything, I suppose.
So it's up to the presidents to decide whether or not to apply a law until challenged?
That's always been the case. He takes an oath to the Constitution. He doesn't take an oath to the Congress. He takes an oath to the Constitution. And if he thinks that the law orders him to do something which is against the Constitution, it's not that he need not, he may not do it.
And so it's only when it's against the Constitution that he can ignore the wishes of the Congress.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And is that the way?
And the signing statements have all been of that nature. The president has never said, this law is perfectly constitutional, there's nothing wrong with it, but I don't like it, so I'm not going to veto it, I'm going to sign it, but I'm not going to pay any attention to it. That he has not said. And if he did say it, you could take him to court and you would win very easily.
Let me ask you a Commonwealth Club question. As we discussed before this event started, I told you that the Commonwealth Club is devoting a good bit of its energy now to trying to strengthen and improve governance in the state of California. What advice do you have for us in terms of where we as a group of concerned citizens should be putting our energies with respect to governance more broadly?
Redistricting.
You know that's what we're working on.
Well, I have heard, but I believe that so.
You would put that as a major issue?
It's the major issue because the situation in this state and many others, but actually rather acutely in this state, is an obvious offense to democracy and a disgrace. And everybody agrees except the people who hold office under this system.
We're working hard on it. Let me read another question. It bothers me, this is a written question, it bothers me that for many years politicians and most of the public feel and are programmed in schools and to agree in the media to believe that the U.S. has a predominant role in liberty, little recognition of other free and democratic, liberty-loving countries. Is this an accurate description, and is it fair? Where do we stand, in your opinion?
Well, we are a lot freer than almost anybody else. I think that's quite clear. In some respects, we are less than some other countries, not too many. In some respects, we're less free. In respect to freedom of speech, there is no country on the globe that has freedom of speech to the extent we do. As a matter of fact, European countries think we're crazy. We have so much freedom of speech. In other respects, we may be less free. But we do pretty well. And certainly to stand on our tippy toes and deny that other countries do as well or better in some respects than we do, is a bad thing to do, among other things, because it's false and ignorant. And you don't want to teach ignorance.
There are a whole series of questions about constitutional law, and let me ask you this.
Well, I do. There's a wonderful story about a great constitutional lawyer, Thomas Reed Powell, who in the 40s was asked to swear an oath to support the Constitution. And he said, well, why not? It supported me all my life. That's how he made his living. And it's sort of how I make my living. So you go right ahead if you want.
Well, they're pretty general. What are the biggest challenges facing constitutional law now, in your view? Or are there big challenges facing constitutional law?
There are dozens all over the place. I don't think there are. No, I don't think I could create a list and put one thing or another at the top of it.
One interesting thing we've learned recently is that the Supreme Court seems to be short on cases to address. Why is that, and what's going on here?
I don't know why that is. And neither do the justices, and neither does Linda Greenhouse. It's a mystery. There are lots of possible explanations. One of them is that the courts of appeals now are largely staffed by judges who have roughly the same point of view as the judges on the Supreme Court, and therefore they don't come up with decisions that need to be reversed, which is also why most of the cases that they do take and do reverse come from the Ninth Circuit, which is the California Circuit.
Another tribute to our independence in California.
It's not bad. It's all right. You can't get much smarter than Steve Reinhardt and Alex Kaczynski.
Why does the Supreme Court and not the people have the jurisdiction to choose the President of the United States?
Well, it doesn't, and that's a loaded question, and I think it would take more than any of us have for me to get into that.
Okay. Why do you think Americans push for rules and regulations? In many other countries, people don't seem to expect such protections in public spaces. I'm not sure what the questioner is talking about, but...
Well, we are a very law-bound society. We've got rules and regulations everywhere about everything. Not more than other countries. What we have more of than most other countries is lawyers and lawsuits. And I think what your questioner may be noticing is that in this country, we're ready to bring a lawsuit about almost everything. Whether there are enough Santa Clauses on the creche in the city park and so on, which other countries perhaps might not consider worth having a litigation about.
And on that exact point, what is your opinion of the level of litigiousness in the U.S., and is there a way to move away from that trend?
Yes, well, it's over the top, there is a way to move away from it, and it should be taken, and that is what I call the English rule, and that is with exceptions, loser pays. That'll do it. So you bring a lawsuit, but if it's no good, you haven't cost only yourself, but somebody else $500,000, you could pay the whole freight. That would be a very good change.
We are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Charles Fried, one of the most well-regarded legal scholars in the country, discussing personal freedom versus government intervention. So let's look at the electronic voting machines. What do you think about the problems there, and should we...
I am not an expert on that. Voting machines should be accurate, and if they're not, that's a shame and that should be changed, but I don't know about it.
Broadly speaking, you seem to be pretty happy with the way the legal system is running in this country. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think the litigiousness bothers me. Mm-hmm. There are many things. I think our tort system is the seventh wonder of the world, but one which nobody is inclined to copy. That is an absurdity. But I think our judicial system and our court system is really very good, particularly at the federal level.
You quoted from Lincoln, and if you could imagine the Founding Fathers reappearing on the scene and looking over the situation and giving us a report on their assessment of how effectively we're implementing their ideas,
I think they would find it all quite familiar and quite satisfactory, and the problems they had are the ones we have. I mean, after all, think of the election of 1800, and that couldn't have been better. I mean, the election of 2000 couldn't have been better than the one that couldn't have been worse than the one that happened 200 years ago. No, they were a very contentious lot, and campaigns were even more vicious. My goodness, the things Thomas Jefferson and his people allowed themselves to say about his opponents in that presidential election. No. Things haven't changed all that much. And those were wonderful people. They were the best.
That's reassuring. You said that money is not bad, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you bet.
How do you feel about money and political campaigns? Would you be more comfortable with federally financed political campaigns or putting some kind of limits on how much people can spend?
I would not put limits on how much they can spend. That would be an offense against liberty, and that's what the Supreme Court believed. And in fact, they more or less, I don't know whether it was unanimous or 7-2, reaffirmed that just last year when the great state of Vermont, which is a remarkable place, thought that they knew better than the Supreme Court and put on expenditure limits, and they were knocked down, they were slapped down. On the other hand, federal financing is not a bad idea. I think there's much to be said for that.
So the Commonwealth Club also supports that. You'd be
That's fine. That's just fine.
Good.
I'm all for public schools, I just like vouchers too, and I like private schools.
You are a libertarian, I think, declared to be. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, that's how I would be characterized, but I believe in redistributive taxation, and I'm a humane person, and I believe that that's got to happen, too.
A humane libertarian.
Yeah, kind of gentler.
What about eminent domain? Is being attacked? Is it bad for society? The ability?
Well, it's in our Constitution. What's bad about it is that the Constitution says just compensation, and the compensation is almost never the equivalent of the market value of the property. So to that extent, there's a little bit of theft going on. And when the theft involves putting the money into the pocket of another private person rather than using it for a public park or a public highway, then it's really very, very dubious.
When you look across the current world leaders, do you have a sense that things are not moving in a good direction, or that they are moving in a good direction?
Discouraging. I don't see the Churchills. I don't see the De Gaulles. I don't see the Adenauers. It's discouraging. Best that I've seen around is Tony Blair, and he's not perfect. But he's wonderfully articulate.
He's a very supportive guy, though.
Pardon?
He's very supportive when he gets behind something.
And he can explain it. I'm like, well, he can explain it. I'll leave it at that.
We have unfortunately reached the point in our program where I can only ask you one more question. So several people have asked about your own experiences as a lawyer and as appearing in the Supreme Court so many times. What is your most favorite legal victory and your worst defeat?
My worst defeat, that's easy. That's the independent counsel case when in 1988 I argued that the independent counsel statute was unconstitutional. And when I was in court and the decision was handed down 7-1 against me, I called up my dentist who said that he wanted to take a tooth out. And I said, do you suppose you could do it in the next half hour? But I console myself with the thought that if I had argued not Morrison v. Olson, but Clinton versus Starr, I would have won that case. Because the independent counsel statute was a big mistake. It's fortunately gone, but I lost that case. The case that I argued that I loved the most came from California, actually. It was Daubert against Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, and it's the case which established the ground rules for the use of scientific evidence in courts. And it's been adopted not only in the federal courts, but I think in every state except I don't know what.
Well, thank you. Our thanks to Charles Fried, professor of law at Harvard University and the author of Modern Liberty and the Limits to Government. We thank our audiences here in San Francisco and on the radio. I'm Bob Saldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. You enjoy that?